The nation doesn't know it yet, but the greatest home field advantage is dough.
He should have known what everybody was going to think. And Ernie, I got one worse than flat earth theory.
Dough!
Theory.
The Houston Astros have made themselves ginormous villains, and what better way to bring baseball into the national consciousness than cheating and villains, which we now have Carlos Correa, Jose Altuve, who apparently wasn't part of it, but I don't think that's going to catch him any leeway. And of course, Dusty Baker, who is now the cleanup crew at the top of that team, begging the MLB to suspend anybody who throws pitches at them. That's where I want to start this one off is, man, what a request. They have been very defiant through this, Correa especially. And he has accepted fault for it himself while trying to save the names of other teammates, most specifically Altuve. But he comes out, he says, you got to look at this in context. You got to know the facts. I mean, it's pretty evident what happened out there. I'm not going to say it's the most disgraceful thing in the world. I don't think you should pull a championship from it because it's pretty evident that they were the best team. And they're still going to be the best team this year. Them are the Yankees. So that's going to show quite in its own way that the Astros probably deserve that championship, especially beating the Dodgers, who the last 10 years have shown nothing of being a champion despite being in the playoffs every single year and losing massive games. Lost to the Red Sox as well, which is its own story. But we go back to their call to not have pitches thrown at them. I mean, these are guys who would throw pitches at other players if they were trotting around the bases the wrong way. And they're going to be defiant and hope for protection when they just circumvent the rules in this very deliberate way. Like, it's so hypocritical to me because I think almost any baseball player would back this code, which I don't agree with, and I've hammered on this show many different times, but now they're going to try to hide behind Rob Manfred in the league and hope that they get some sympathy for how teams are going to come at them. I mean, there are just so many hypocritical people throughout this whole offseason that we're hearing from. But I think the Astros sound the worst in that sense. Maybe second to the Dodgers, who feel like they should have a banner raised by default for taking Houston's away. But I don't like Dusty Baker just on his hands and knees hoping Manfred's going to throw out suspensions and fines when guys get thrown at.
The thing is, he's probably right, though. Because if you look at these sports, all these sports, and like you said, you've been vocal about it, but like throwing at each other is so dumb. It's dangerous. And that might be soft, that might be, you know, a new whatever kind of take, but we're moving towards player safety across the board in all these sports, but we have people throwing a baseball 100 miles an hour at a guy for, you know, whatever. So he's probably right, but there is a code. It's going to happen. You know it's going to happen. I don't know if there will be punishments. I think that after a while, the deliberation of, like, batters getting hit will go away. I think that once we're a month into the season and it's back to baseball, a lot of this smoke will die off.
Well, here's my point. Manfred's going to suspend, I don't know, Clayton Kershaw if he throws that Carlos Correa next year in interleague play. I don't even know if they play each other.
It won't be Kershaw, though. You're going to see
coming up with a hypothetical.
No, I think you're going to see a lot of relievers, like, just taking, you know what I mean? Like, just be like, all right, here's the opportunity.
All right, let me look up a Dodgers reliever to make this realistic.
You know what I mean? Right. Like, I don't think that, first of all, I don't think that throwing at each other should be the norm in baseball. Like I said, that's real dangerous, and there's enough problems with, you know, all kinds of player safety issues across the board to have like a something where it's like a deliberate attempt to injure. And I get it. I get the code. You know, I understand it. It's part of the game. It's just interesting. I don't know if Astros players, I saw some odds saying like they're going to get like something, what is it, 83 hit by pitches this year, something like that, like intentional intent. That was the over under, like 83 batters hit on purpose. That's crazy, but it's going to be interesting to watch.
All right. I found my guy. I was thinking about Pedro Baez, but let's say David Price throws at Carlos Correa.
Don't do this.
Because why not?
Don't,
Price has volunteered quite a few times in his career to uphold the code. So let's say he's willing to do it again. He gets suspended a game for throwing at a guy. And then let's say Matt Barnes of the Red Sox gets pissed that, I don't know, Evan Longoria, does he still play?
I don't know.
Evan Longoria hits a home run and trots too slow. Matt Barnes throws at him. They're not going to suspend Barnes in that situation, but they're going to give special protection to the Astros. I think that's why they sound so ridiculous in this, because I know the Astros would be the first ones to throw at someone over something stupid like a bat flip, but they completely cheat the game and undermine everybody else. And honestly, a couple relief pitchers and these people who feel like they screwed their career by games that they had against them, I think that's kind of ridiculous in its own right, and it shows the extreme that everybody is taking over this story. But what they did is pretty egregious, and if there was any reason to throw at somebody, this would probably be the one.
Yeah.
But nobody wants to see throwing at people banished outright. Like, that's not even a conversation right now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I disagree. I think that's part of why I think some of the things in baseball, some of the unwritten rules, some of the expectations are why I have been, you know, my baseball fandom has been, you know, shrinking and shrinking as the years go on.
Oh, and the sport isn't going to embrace this either. You know, Manfred's going to back them up. You know, he's going to prevent guys from throwing at them just because he wants to keep order and minimize this as much as possible, because it's becoming a stain on him, too. He makes that ridiculous statement.
Rob Manfred, baseball is in a tough spot right now because you have so many players openly just talking open shit about the Astros, like in the press, two reporters right to their, like, you know what I mean? They're just going in. You have, you know, Justin Turner going after the commissioner, Trevor Bauer going after the commissioner, the Astros handling this cheating scandal in one of the weirdest ways ever. I mean, Carlos Correa standing there and be like, well, you don't know. If you weren't there, you don't know. Like, yeah, we did it, but you don't know. I was like, there's so much going on with baseball right now that it's in such a spot where, especially being a Red Sox fan, where they second in baseball for salary dump, there's not like a whole lot. What's the draw right now for someone who's on the fence about wanting to be, you know, really be into this sport?
They want to see some fights.
Yeah, of course, but you can't even see them. You can't even see them because the MLB is so you know, strict about what you can and can't post on the internet.
It's like, absurd.
It's no surprise to me that on Twitter, especially, the NBA in basketball is growing the way it is because they promote us, like, cutting up video and
you know,
posting it and learning how to film breakdown.
I was thinking about this the other day, and baseball is still a cash cow because of TV and things like that.
Of course.
They definitely make the second most money of the major sports. And the NBA, for all the attention, for all the love, for all the hype they get, their money's going down for whatever reason. China, I guess that's a minor reason.
That's probably, yeah. So I don't know if it's minor. That's pretty, I'd be interested to look at the numbers for that.
Well, I'd look at, like, Reddit, too. I mean, they've had people watching on Reddit for so long, not buying the league pass and not locked into their local TV deals because, you know, they can watch the 9-minute highlight on YouTube. There's something to be said about the MLB, even though their popularity and their relevance in the American sports mainstream has absolutely dipped. Their money is not, because they've kept a pretty solid bar on TV rights, video rights, and the thing that hardcore baseball fans are going to go to. They have to go through the right outlets, whether it's MLB TV or their local cable package or NESN streaming, that kind of stuff. And I think that's what's kept it so lucrative.
Of course it's kept it lucrative, but when the other game is more accessible, you see how it right now is touching more people. It feels like, I don't know statistically, but I mean, baseball participation's down, football participation's down, to the youth level, basketball is growing, stuff like that. That's more important. Trevor Bauer said in his video, he said, yeah, it's good to make this money up front and, you know, put all of our media in one place and make people pay to access it. But you start losing people because it's much easier to get into basketball at this point. Like, you can go find games for free. Highlights are everywhere. You don't have to search. Like Trevor Bauer said it too, in I don't know if you saw his video. It's like a 7-minute video on his YouTube channel. It's really good, where he just sits there and talks to the camera and lays out a bunch of issues that the game's having with this kind of thing. And he said it perfectly. He said, Steph Curry makes a highlight, and within seconds, it's on Twitter. Mike Trout goes and robs a home run. You have to go, like, search high and low for it and maybe wait for, like, a game recap on YouTube because it's so much harder to find. Obviously, you don't actually have to. You have to wait till, like, some official account tweets it or someone tweets it, and then it might get ripped down. There's just so many barriers to get into baseball. As a fan who, you know, someone growing up who I used to sit there and watch 120, 130 Red Sox games a year, I can feel it being like, all right, one league seems to be making a bunch of correct decisions in the way it touches fans, and one league isn't. And you have right now a crossroads in the sport where there's a bunch going on. The commissioner doesn't seem to be handling it the best way. And honestly, in terms of the Astros, I wish they just would have owned it. I wish they would have been like, yeah, like we did it. Like, okay. Like well, they keep like Correa's whole thing where he's like, yeah, we did it, but you don't know the whole story. And if you don't know the story, don't talk. It's like, what does that even mean?
Well, that makes me think they're the best team in baseball by far. They have Altuve, Correa, Verlander, top line talent in both their pitching and their batting. I don't think they're going to win it all this year. I think they're going to crumble mentally. This thing's going to follow them. Every single game, it's going to be the story, and they're not going to be able to get it to go away. And I hear the murmurs today that their stadium or the National Stadium, one of those two, is going to try to suppress the fan heckling. But it'll still be the question in interviews after games. It's going to be a storyline for all 162, and then into the playoffs, it's only going to ramp up. I don't know if mentally they're able to handle this because they haven't been so far through the press. They've just crumbled and gotten so defensive, and they strike back at it in such a way that makes me think it's in the back of their heads and it's going to be all year long. That's the story, and the MLB has to embrace this. The Yankees are going to step up to the plate. Of course, it has to be the Yankees because, you know, Lord knows they've been able to handle the Astros in that big moment. I guess we're going to have to rally around it, and baseball is going to have to embrace it too. Because the Red Sox aren't ready to do it. I mean, they're going to be struggling to make the playoffs this year because they go ahead and trade their star for money.
I don't even want to talk about them. They are like, this might be the least interested I've been ever going into Red Sox season in my life.
They talk about the conversation we just had. They're making more money than ever. They're raising prices to access this team. And they go ahead and trade their most important player since Ted Williams.
I mean, who cares when you own the team, Liverpool, the television station, the newspaper? Like, get out of here. I don't even want to talk about John Henry and the Red Sox. The way they trading Mookie Betts is honestly, it's one of those moves that you hear about and it's like that changed my fandom.
And think of the deal that they agreed to in the first place. The bum with the arm issues and this outfielder with back issues. Now they go and make it a little bit.
He's got questionable pass. He's got some stuff too.
Yeah. We'll talk about that with Chris and think of some of the concerns that have come up about him and what prompted the Red Sox to go forward and make this guy, honestly, the centerpiece of their team. This man is now going to be judged.
Mookie Betts. They got Alex Verdugo. Are you kidding me?
Think about Verdugo himself.
Marcus Lynn Betts, the second best player in baseball for a salary dump.
This is the angle no one's talking about. And this has been talked about ad nauseum. We'll go into it a little bit with Chris coming up in just a few minutes here. But think about Verdugo. This guy's going to be stuck out in right field now. He's the return. He's the centerpiece of this trade. He's going to be judged on scale with Mookie, and it's a pinnacle that he's never going to be able to reach. Like, we know all automatically that Alex Verdugo is never going to be Mookie Betts, so he's set up to fail instantly coming in, not to mention his injury.
There's one player better than Mookie Betts in the world. Like, this isn't just a homegrown player that we all loved. This is one of the best players in baseball that they got rid of when they definitely could have kept him.
There was no reason they couldn't have kept him. I'm a little weary about the 13 years, but here's the thing. They didn't have to go out and just make any deal to do it. And they did not have to use him as sweetener to dump David Price. And here I am defending David Price. as a fourth or fifth rotation guy, but that's the swings that this Red Sox team makes. They don't sign John Lester, who helped them win a World Series. So they have to go out and sign this unreliable guy who they know better than anyone is unreliable in David Price. They get a World Series out of it because they just spend to the max and bail themselves out of these bad decisions.
All right.
But they make
it
so hard
on
themselves.
Don't talk about his ALCS in his World Series that year. Don't skate over Price in the ALCS and in the World Series.
Welcome to Dome Theory, the show that used to be known as The Bobcast. We got this thing started back in 2016 as a way for me to hone my broadcasting speaking skills. I'm Bobby Manning, and on this show, we take you from stories of people who aspire to do great things to the people they are now, the ones who did those great things. And I've interviewed Jeff Perlman, Damon Amendolara, Shea Serrano, and many more. Journalists, athletes, Jason Tatum, Brad Stevens. I cover the Boston Celtics for SB Nation as well as the Syracuse Orange, and I love Syracuse basketball. So when we need to rename this show, I decided the apartment complex I lived in Syracuse Theory, along with the Dome, where I spent quite a few hours during my college days covering Syracuse basketball, as two words to redefine this show. And with these great guests, I'm going to bring my friends and my longtime co-host, Jamel Smith, into the picture for discussions on life, music, and the way culture intersects with sports and my own life. So it's going to get personal around here at times. It's going to get fun. And I'm going to continue to teach myself through this show. Today we have Chris Cotillo, who I followed for baseball for a long time. As many of you know, I started covering baseball when I first started writing back in 2012. That was my favorite sport growing up. I love the Boston Red Sox, love Fenway Park, everything about it, all the way down to video games that I played quite a bit back in middle school, high school. But the game has changed a lot, and it's needed new life, speed, energy, and storylines to captivate a generation of people who don't have the attention span to follow a four-hour game. So as we talked about, social media, but also storylines, are critically needed for this sport. And we have a big one with the Houston Astros cheating scandal. What kind of role does that play in the possible return of baseball interest in 2020? We're about to find out with Chris Cotillo, who covers the Red Sox down at Mass Live in Western Mass and is currently in Florida with the team. We talk to Chris right now on Dome Theory. Don't forget to subscribe on realbobmanning.com. We have Stitcher, iTunes, and Spotify links, as well as many other platforms. Here he is, as promised, Chris Cotillo. This is about the time in every week where we do an interview, and he is joining us from Florida, which I'm going to be down there come March. I'm really anticipating it, and Chris is already enjoying it. Chris, I assume that you've done a few spring trainings at this point, but ever since I won again the sports media, that was always something that excited me most, because we're both from Massachusetts. We both know once February comes around, it's unbearable and you have to get out of it. So this probably has to be the best part of the sports calendar for you.
Yeah, no, it's one of the busiest. I mean, there's no days off during the stretch. There's something going on over at the complex or at, you know, one of these road stadiums in Florida every day for the whole time we're down here. So it's busy, it's tiring. It's a much different routine because we're getting up at 7 a.m. instead of, you know, the normal 11 or 12 that happens during the season because there's 8 o'clock clubhouse every day. But no, it's awesome. It was a little cold on Friday, and I called home and talked to my parents and said, yeah, it's freezing here, it's 50, and their response is not made for air. So considering it was 20-25 degrees there, but about 70 today, beautiful blue skies, so definitely good to get out of the cold. And then once you're done here, it's pretty much other than a few cold days in April, pretty much done with winter until next year.
I talked to Jeff Perlman about spring training. It's one of my favorite topics. Back when he wrote for Sports Illustrated, they just had unlimited money to spend. They were living in like condos for the whole month. It was a pretty luxurious life that they were living back then when they had money to pour out of their behinds. What is life like for you during this next month or so that you're down there?
Yeah, we are. We do it a little differently. We do really kind of go hard on the first month of spring training at Mass Live. We go, we've been here. This is my exact midpoint, really, today. 2 weeks in, 2 weeks to go. Me and my partner and I, Chris Smith from Mass Live, my partner on the beat, we get an Airbnb and, you know, get up at 7, which is, like I said, a huge change for me as someone who's not a morning person at all. Drive over there. We're usually there from anywhere from 8 to 12 to 8 to 5, depending on the day, and get dinner and come home. It's not luxurious. It's kind of, you know, it's a 7 days a week routine. It's definitely fun, but yeah, I don't think the those SI days seem like they're long ago.
What's can you describe the B&B for me?
Yeah, I'm on a very comfortable couch right now. I'm going to watch the Celtics Lakers this afternoon. You know, kind of small house, not on the water, but not too far. So we can sneak over to the beach if we want.
All right, let's throw it back. What we do here on this show, the Bobcast, now known as Dome Theory, is we take it from days when people aspired to do something to doing it now. Back when you went to Algonquin High School, what was life like for you?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was kind of the normal high school life until senior year. Senior year, it was a huge difference where, you know, I started breaking stories and started trying to make a name for myself in the industry I now work full time in. Worked for SB Nation, MLB Daily Dish at the time, and started a Twitter account where I was trying to, you know, be on top of rumors and news and all that kind of stuff. And ended up connecting through Twitter and LinkedIn and some other social media sites with some people in baseball. Was able to get a couple of big stories, and then my senior year, was kind of doing this kind of professional life on the side while trying to graduate high school. So, and that turned into going to school for journalism at UNC and graduating with a journalism degree and ending up with Mass Live right after school.
At the age you were doing it then, from high school into college, how were you able to get the trust of the sources that you were working with, especially as you were starting out there and hadn't really made a name for yourself yet?
Yeah, a lot of it was, you know, I guess looking back, luck of finding good people who said, you know, someone helped me out when I was your age, and I want to do the same, kind of a pay it forward thing. It's something I try to do now when people in high school ask me, you know, how to make it in the industry or whatever. And but a lot of it was, you know, I think the social media is huge in doing that. People really admiring the work ethic, admiring what I was trying to do as a high schooler. I think, you know, there's a lot of people that looked at it, looked at an email from me or looked at a DM from me and said, oh, I have no idea who this kid is, delete or screw off kid. And that's probably, you know, the normal natural response to it. So those who, you know, gave me the time of day, I appreciate. And then it kind of snowballs from there. Once you go to the winter meeting, this person introduces you to this person. And from there, it all kind of, you get to kind of grow your network. So, yeah, you know, I think it was a very unique way of doing it, obviously, without, you know, having a normal career path or doing it as kind of the traditional way. But hopefully I was able to gain trust quickly and kind of expand that network from there.
How have those winter meetings changed? That's something I've heard lately, is that those have changed quite a bit, even over the last decade. There used to be a lot more action, activity there. Now things are just so spread out over the off season now that it's not really as big of a splash time or even a networking time as it used to be. Is that something you felt?
Yeah, I mean, it's been different for me in the last 2 years. My first five, I was with SB Nation and doing the national thing and writing for MLB Daily Dish and trying to be on top of everything that was going on in the whole league. The last 2 years have been on the beat, so really focusing on what the Red Sox are doing and doing it through those two lenses, it's much different. You know, it's I think my first year was going is 2013. Robinson Cano signed, I think, the night before, and so that was kind of the big storyline. And you know, there's a lot of guys, Curtis Granderson and Jared Saltalamacchia were big free agents then, and they signed during the meetings. And you know, there's been some years where it's really been slow. There's been some years where nothing's happened during those meetings, especially, you know, the last two off seasons before this most recent one. we didn't see a lot of movement that time of year. We saw a lot of these big guys, obviously Harper, Machado, and guys like that signing in April. I mean, in March, excuse me. This year, it was kind of back to the winter meetings were a spectacle. You know, we saw obviously Garrett Cole, Steven Strasburg, and Anthony Rendon kind of back-to-back-to-back nights. It was really good for baseball to kind of get that off-season calendar back going. I think in terms of networking, the event is just so big now that some logistically, it's hard, you know, for these hotels to be able to accommodate anything. I think they're spreading things out. This year, the major league side was at one hotel in San Diego. The minor league side was at another on another hotel. So I think spreads it out a little bit, makes it harder to network with everyone. But it's still definitely one of my favorite events of the year. It's one where, you know, any baseball fan, it's really cool. You get to see the business side and anybody aspiring. You know, you never know who you're going to run into. Those days are long. They go long into the night. And you'll see some people, very notable people in baseball just walking through the lobby, which is, even to me, 7 years in now, it's still really cool.
We just said goodbye to you over at CLNS Media. You were the host of Red Sox Beat for a year or two, I think. You had been with the company back to like one of its earliest days, writing for when it was CLNS Radio. Can you take me back to when you first connected with Nick and got going here and how you used this platform alongside what you were doing with SB Nation and some of the early stuff in high school there?
Yeah, that was, you know, I was looking at trying to find a piece that I wrote for CLNS to see how bad my writing was back then. Hopefully it's improved in 8 years, but and you know, and actually going to school for it. But it, I remember, you know, kind of finding a site and seeing, kind of covering the Red Sox. Obviously, never going to a game, never being credentialed, anything like that. CLNS was not what it is now back then. So, you know, writing series previews, and I tried columns, I guess, as a 16, 17-year-old, as if anybody – no one wants to hear what I have to say now, so I can't imagine what they wanted – you know, how little they wanted to hear back then. But just trying to, you know, kind of start somewhere and get some writing experience. I remember, you know, with Nick and some other people that were there. I'm not sure if they're there anymore. But, yeah, it was cool to come back for a year and do the Red Sox Beat podcast with you guys. I had fun doing it. We just, you know, with some stuff with Mass Live that we'll be kind of announcing later, kind of decided to centralize a lot of the podcasting stuff there. So, but it was cool to, you know, kind of come full circle now, be on the beat and, you know, talk to Nick again and talk to some of the people there, because there are people that were there way back when I started. I was a high schooler and way before I was, actually, working in this industry.
So you come back, you make a show all those years later. How different is that for you? Because for so many years, you were focused on writing, sourcing, those kind of things. Now you have to formulate a show. You're talking, you're bringing guests in, you're doing stuff like that. How big of a change was that for you when you moved to the podcasting side of things?
Yeah, you know, it was something that it was a little bit different. You know, I think the a lot of times we had beat writers on from, you know, either my partner Chris Smith at Mass Live, or we had beat writers from other teams come on, or fellow beat writers to cover the Red Sox and kind of discuss the news of the week. And it's kind of, you know, the mixture of straight news and kind of column writing, but verbally, you know, giving opinions. And, you know, I've listened to enough sports radio to know, you know, how things kind of go, but you know, hopefully we weren't at that crazy take level on the Red Sox beat.
Do you have one take from the past that you regret?
One take from the past that I regret?
A take from the past or a column or something like that?
I'll bring you all the way back to the CLNS days for that. The early CLNS days, sophomore year of high school or junior year of high school version of Chris Cotillo wrote a column that Ben Sherrington's off-season additions in the winter going into 2013 were really great for clubhouse chemistry, but really horrible for on-field product. And there's something like if there was a trophy for most nice best guys and best clubhouse guys, they would win, but that's not what it's all about. And turned out they were good guys and they played it all out of their minds that year and obviously won the third World Series of the John Henry era. So I'm glad that take is no longer available on the internet.
Yeah, that was the old version of the website. We'll keep that in the past. They have done some funky things over the years. Now that I look back on it, putting Hanley Ramirez in left field, you just wrote about Daniel Bard when he moved to the rotation and how that just completely demoralized his career. I'm trying to think, too. They just threw the catcher there, Swihart, in the outfield one of his last years. Mm-hmm. They've been moving. That's been one of the weirdest things that they've done over the years is throw guys in different places, and it hasn't quite worked out a lot of the time.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of that is, you know, they trying to find the balance between having these high-priced free agents play in the spots where they want to. You know, I think it's easier a lot of times to throw. And I was not on the beat before middle of 2018, so I don't remember the exact ins and outs of why they moved Hanley or why they moved Swihart and all that stuff. But, you know, it's tough to find a spot where you know, you're moving these kids around. You have to, these kids come up, they just want a chance to play and play anywhere. You know, you look at Michael Chavis, who is the team's top prospect. When he was drafted, he was a shortstop. And they realized soon after, all right, let's move him around. Let's move him to third. So, you know, his first two options there are shortstop and third, where the Red Sox have two franchise players now in Trenton, Bogarts and Devers. And then, you know, last year when he first came up, a lot of first base, a lot of second base. Now he's going to be kind of splitting. Those are two positions that he really, you know, didn't play. Second base, he really played before he even got up to the majors last year. He kind of learned that on the fly, and first base is one that he just, you know, kind of learned in the Arizona Fall League before. So these guys get switched around. In the case of Swihart, you know, and you have other guys that are entrenched in that spot, and obviously Vasquez, they viewed as a franchise catcher from the jump. You know, moving these guys around, these guys, some of them don't adjust as well. Obviously, Chavis has, and it'll be interesting to see. You know, Bobby Dalbec and some of these other guys. Bobby Dalbec looks like the first baseman of the future, but with Casas coming down the line and how J.D. Martinez fits in all that, and, you know, in spring training, we'll even see some wacky combinations, see some wacky things out there. Maybe have Chavis try the outfield or Peraza a little bit in the outfield. So, yeah, they try to get the most talent on the field as they can. They try to hide potential defensive deficiencies, and sometimes it looks crazy when you see it.
It reminds me of back when we used to play the 2K games, and you just put Prince Fielder at catcher because you could do it in the game.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want, exactly.
I want to go back to your college days. What brought you to UNC? Was that a place you always wanted to go to, or were there other choices in the mix there? And how do you look back on that decision that you made at that time in your life?
Yeah, no, I was a huge Notre Dame fan growing up. My cousin went there, and he went there during the Jeff Samardzija, Brady Quinn days when they were really good. I wanted to go to a big sports school as I got closer. You know, as I was starting to apply for colleges, I looked up Notre Dame's journalism program, realized I didn't have one, and I just had to cross that off the list once I realized that was, you know, what I wanted to pursue. So that was a surprise. I thought every school had every – growing up, I thought every school had every major, and I also thought that the head coaches at every school taught a class like high school teachers did. So I thought, like, Charlie Weiss taught a class and Mike Bray taught a class at Notre Dame, or that Roy was teaching some, you know, exercise sports science class. That wasn't the case. But, yeah, once I got into my, you know, yeah, that would be awesome. But, yeah, once I kind of got into it, I visited a few different schools around the country, and, yeah, I just kind of visited really blindly, not knowing. And I didn't really put a ton of, you know, a lot of people stressed out about their college decisions, and I just thought, oh, you know, Chapel Hill looked awesome. I could see myself going there, and I went, and it was a great decision. Obviously, I loved it.
How did it feel to go to a place that was warmer? Because me, I went to Syracuse, and it was worse going there during the winter. Like, I'd be happy coming home, and it made me feel better about Boston weather. So you were coming back during the breaks, I'd imagine, and feeling horrible.
Yeah, my freshman year was the winter of 14-15, which is like the worst winter on record.
Yeah, I remember that one well.
I remember. Yeah, I came home to see UNC play BC in basketball, which was kind of an hindsight, a waste of time, because, you know, the way BC actually won in Chapel Hill this year, making me eat my words, but that historically has not been really a tough matchup. But I wanted to go home and knew they'd be, you know, playing there. So I went home, and I remember this, the mountain, the snow being crazy. But no, I the weather was great. You know, this time of year is kind of, you know, at least I get to have the Florida part of it now. But, you know, when being at home and seeing, you know, Snapchats or Instagrams from Chapel Hill, and it's like in March, especially, you know, with big basketball games and March Madness. I remember, you know, those days were always beautiful days when we go out and watch some of the tournament games, and at home in March, it's obviously never that nice. So yeah, that was a good part of it too.
This season, Syracuse got off to its worst start ever under Jim Boeheim, and it looked like the season was going to be over by December.
I looked over to UNC, and it started to make me feel better. Cole Anthony got hurt, and they just never got back on their feet again. And they are having by far their worst season.
So how have you been coping with that?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think they got blown out by Louisville the other night. Louisville blew out Carolina yesterday, so. Even on that one, but no, it's been a crazy season. You know, there's a lot of factors when you look back to recruiting and, you know, injuries and a lot of different things that have caused Carolina to be what they are this year. It's not something I expected, you know, having a top two or three recruit in the country, but you know, I look at it this way, that in the last, you know, I've been a fan of them since my freshman year. So that's 5 years. They were a four seed my freshman year. And then the last 4 years, it was like, a one seed, a two seed, a one seed, and a one seed. So we can eat 1 year of being 3-13 in the ACC and a lot of talent coming in next year, and hopefully we'll be right back on track.
I'd imagine you spent more time focused on baseball when you were in college, but one thing...
No. No.
Really? All right, correct me then.
Not really.
Correct me.
Yeah,
then,
no,
then.
I was... I didn't really... you know, Matt, got to know the Carolina baseball program a little bit, some of the guys, some of the... and some of the coaches and everything, and went to some games, but and obviously was focused on baseball from a work perspective. But yeah, as a fan perspective, I always said, like, it came at the perfect time for me personally, because you do baseball, and I grew up a huge Red Sox fan. And once you get into it, you lose that, definitely. You know, you root for, you know, the guys that are good to you. You root for your story. You root for games under 3 hours and that kind of stuff. So, you know, getting into college, I felt like, you know, there's a void missing of, I don't have the Red Sox anymore to root for. So to find a college team that I was really passionate about was cool. And yeah, a big, big Carolina, you know, Carolina basketball became as interested as I was in a team, period, still is.
All right, yeah, I understand that dynamic fully, especially when you start getting into the things that annoy you or frustrate you about the teams that you're covering. Like, you really start to hone in on those things, and you really can't put a blinder to them as much. And I felt that with the Red Sox, too, at least since 2014, and we'll get into the move that most recently irked a lot of Red Sox fans. What is your best memory from those 4 years of UNC basketball, and what was your worst memory?
That's the easiest question of all time. Best memory, well, the worst memory leads to the best memory. So the worst memory, sophomore year, Chris Jenkins from Villanova hits a buzzer beater to win the national championship.
Were you at that game? Obviously. Where were you watching that game?
No, I was in Chapel Hill, which was, it was arguably worse. Probably is worse.
Yeah, definitely.
So that was horrible. That was the worst moment as a sports fan I can imagine. I mean, really. And, you know, you don't think that you're going to get – even going to a powerhouse basketball school, you don't think you're going to get more than one chance to be in the national championship game. I mean, it doesn't happen in 4 years. And then the next year, they came back and, with really an all-time tournament run, playing a lot of really good teams, a lot of really good games. The national championship game, obviously, and winning it, and the redemption kind of story. But and this is really in the weeds of college basketball, if people remember it. But Luke May hit a buzzer beater in the Elite Eight against Kentucky in a back-and-forth game where Malik Monk and De'Aaron Fox were just going off in the Elite Eight. And Luke May, who was like, you know, eighth guy, ninth guy on the team, who at that point, who turned into a really good college player and an all-American and all-ACC type in his last 2 years, hit a buzzer beater, send him to the Final Four, and watching that at a bar in Chapel Hill, I have to say, is probably number one. Close second is actually winning a national championship. I mean, there's not much that's sweeter than that.
Marcus Page, he got robbed, didn't he? I mean, his shot was just so much better than Chris Jenkins.
Yes, yeah, I know. It's the most forgotten best shot of all time. And the thing, they were down 10 in that game with a couple minutes left. If Chris Jenkins didn't hit that shot, if a Carolina player didn't set a screen on another Carolina player by accident, Marcus Page's shot would be really remembered, and Carolina would absolutely win that in overtime.
What was the biggest lesson you learned from college, either in life or in journalism or school or anything?
Great question. I don't know. I learned a lot in the J school about kind of the ins and outs of, I kind of did. Yeah. I think it was that, you know, the, I was kind of practicing before having the classroom part of it. In journalism, you know, I was covering things and out there working, but to have the background of media law and ethics and AP style and all that stuff, and really kind of have all those tools to go full time at it after college, I think was the biggest thing.
You know what? You know, the biggest one for me, actually, at least in the classroom, just how much social media stinks. Because, you know, it's funny. Yeah. We both came up quite a bit using social media, and you think it's the greatest thing in the world.
Right.
And then you see how much money it pulled from journalism and just how unreliable it is as a way of connecting with people and stuff like that. That was the biggest eye-opener for me. And that was actually one of the last things I learned there.
Yeah, that's true, too.
All right, so let's get into the spring training. You opened it up getting a little bit of crap for your Chris Sale tweet that he was sick but healthy. Do you regret that one?
No, it makes perfect sense. It doesn't require any further explanation. I said it on Section 10. I'll say it again. Everybody know what I meant. The guy who had a shoulder injury in 18. And was shut down with an elbow injury in 19. What we're worried about is the arm, pneumonia, walking pneumonia, the flu, all aside. He's healthy with the arm. He's ready to go. He was sick, but fully in terms of injury, healthy. I got a lot of that tweet kind of went off, and a lot of people responded to it. And I thought it was pretty funny. I get, you know, as a writer, he probably should have better English than that. But in baseball speak, it made perfect sense.
It was funny. I'll agree with everybody else on that one, but I'm with you on that from a principal standpoint. Number two, it was really sad the way they opened the spring training. Of course, I think it was 1 year ago that Nick Cafardo passed away, right?
Right.
And John Altobelli, of course, gained massive respect and praise around the Massachusetts area for his career in the Cape Cod Baseball League. And even as he's gone to California in the final years of his life, still had a very strong ties to the area. And seeing his story rise, at least around this area, to the same level of prominence that Kobe Bryant's passing did in the same incident there, was just awesome journalism, because you're always looking for that local angle or something that has relevance in the area that you're at, and everybody around here jumped on his story. I thought it permeated at that high of a level when everybody in the world's talking about Kobe, and he of course got a tribute to open the spring training as well. How much have you learned about him in the last few months?
It's good. I think, you know, in tragedies like that where there's such a prominent person like Kobe involved, obviously a ton of the attention's on them, but the fact that, you know, all the other people on board have been talked about is really cool and a nice tribute as well. Altobelli, someone I had not heard of before, just like you said, being, you know, East Coast guy, and he was on the West Coast, but a lot of people in baseball had heard of him. He has a son, JJ, who is a scout for the Red Sox, so I don't personally know, but it's been cool to see. As soon as it happened, you know, the Red Sox organization really rounded around them and decided to really support that family. You know, there's a GoFundMe. Chaim Bloom the next day issued a statement with, you know, the GoFundMe and the whole scouting department. So it's been cool to see that. And I know there's a tribute to Kobe and Gianna this week in LA at Staples after the Celtics game today, and I think that's tomorrow. So it's been you know, it shows, I think, also the strength of not just the Red Sox family, but the baseball family and all the tributes that have poured in for him and his family and everybody else.
And I can picture the kind of person he was being around the Cape League last summer. And you hear about how great and cool and fun that league is, and then you have to feel it to actually absorb it. It is awesome baseball. It's so competitive. Mm-hmm. It's so quick, the way that the season progresses and how much intensity there is to try to get to that title. I definitely think that's one of the coolest things baseball has to offer, period. Have you ever gotten to see games down there?
Yeah, when I was little, when we were going on vacation down there. Obviously, it's it's extremely tough covering the Red Sox and getting down there because it's right, obviously, in the big part of the season. But, you know, you look at just the list, speak for themselves. You know, I think it's cool. You know, go to a game, grab a program, and then stash it away and look at it 6-7 years down the line. You're like, oh, my God, I just saw all these all-stars I didn't even know. But when I went way back.
Look at Adam Berry. I mean, Altobelli. It's a tough name. He coached Aaron Judge.
Right. Jeff McNeil and some other guys. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I remember going in 04 and doing a random game. Found the program a few years later, and Jacoby Ellsbury was on the team, which, you know, obviously he made his mark in this area, and then now is hated by New Yorkers. So he's checked every box you could want in New England.
Well, let's write this name down. The MVP, the champion from last summer, led the league in average, Nick Gonzalez from New Mexico State. I'm writing that name down, second baseman. I'm going to see where he's at in 5 years. Yep. I'm going to do exactly
from
that.
Traditional powerhouse at New Mexico State.
Led all of college baseball in average last year, too, out of that school. So let's move on to – I'm going to preface this conversation because – I want to know how you feel about it, but nationally, we hear a lot about pulling in outside interest in baseball. You obviously have your hardcore baseball fans who are going to love it no matter what, and then there's always this talk of pulling in the casual fan, and that seems to be a big topic around this Astros controversy, because the thinking is the anger, the hate, the fuel, the rivalries around baseball that could form around this could pull in the casual fan. And it feels like the Astros, not everybody else around the league, obviously, because they are throwing a ton of shade, including the Red Sox. But even the commissioner are trying to, you know, swell this down a little bit. Dusty Baker's asking for pitches not to be thrown at them. Do you feel like MLB should embrace this controversy as just a, you know, generation of rivalry, or do you think they're doing a good job by trying to swell this a little bit?
Everybody loves the villains, and also everybody, you know, that saying is true, as stupid as it sounds. You know, any publicity is good publicity. I think you turn on ESPN and you turn on, you know, PTI around the horn, and this stuff's being talked about every day. It's the humdrum of spring training of, you know, what we write about every day, as important as it is to a lot of diehard fans. You know, Chris Sale throwing a side session versus a live BP was a discussion of the day. At the end of the day, I'm not going to remember this in 3 days. No one's going to remember it, but we'll always remember this Astros scandal, you know, and everything that's come with it. Obviously, there's been a lot of interest in the Red Sox relation to it with what happened with Cora. And I think it's actually great for baseball. And I think, obviously, there's a line where if guys are getting thrown at and guys are getting hurt, guys are getting death threats, and people are wishing harm against their family, that's obviously past the line. But, you know, throwing shade, and we're getting some of the not in Red Sox camp, because it's like Switzerland, because number one, they're under investigation themselves, and number two, they don't want to disrespect Alex Cora. So that's kind of Red Sox, other than Jonathan Lucroy, who had been here for 30 seconds before he launched into that the other day. He didn't have any ties to the other previous thing. The Red Sox are being very neutral on it, but in 28 camps, some of these writers are getting the juiciest quotes they've ever gotten. In the Astros camp, there's obviously plenty to cover. So I think it's great. You know, I think it'll go into the season. It'll be really interesting to see, you know, how the Astros are welcomed in every road city they go into. And they're the villains, and we'll see if that can galvanize them or, you know, cause rifts within their own clubhouse. So it'll be it's a fascinating season. I think there's a lot more intrigue for this year than there has been in past years.
What do you think about the fact that we knew this in November, and only within the past month it's blown up to the level it has, both from a player, media, and national perspective?
Yeah, I think it's just a result of that report coming out, and when it did, Astros, you know, PR push to make this go away has been as bad as maybe ever. It's, you know, PR 101, how not to handle something, including right up to the apologies the other day in spring training. You know, baseball players, when they go home for the offseason, they are off for the offseason. That's it. And they're done. And you don't really hear from them. You know, we don't get to talk to these guys, you know, unless they go out of their way to do an interview. So these guys are all coming to camp, and it's the first question they're asked. And it's become, you know, it's gotten resurfaced because of that. So I think that's really why we've seen it in the last couple of weeks. I think it's quieted down in the last couple of days. This week we should have the Red Sox report released, and obviously whatever comes of that will come with its own backlash or its own reaction.
Yeah.
And, so we'll see. So something to look forward to.
And I like that you said everybody's just a little leery about that, because everyone's forgotten about the Red Sox angle in this, that they're under investigation, that Alex Cora was their coach. They won the World Series in 2018, and they had their own situation with the replay room. So we're going to hear about that this week, you say. Ian Kinsler, I saw you wrote about, said that nothing was going on besides the traditional catcher to second base type stuff that's been going on in the game forever. But what's your expectation of what we're going to learn from the Red Sox side of things?
Well, I think, you know, there's really conflicting things on which way this is going to go. Number one, I think a huge factor that everybody forgets, the Red Sox are going to be viewed as repeat offenders. So they had that Apple Watch, which was actually a Fitbit back in 2017, where, you know, coach was relaying signs, and that was a huge scandal. And,
that was under Farrell, right?
Yeah, because there weren't that many rules. But the fact that it was under Farrell will matter little in the eyes of the league, who just look at the organization as repeat offenders. So that is important, I think, to remember. This will be, you know, the Red Sox promise at that point. We're not going to do anything even close to illegal from now on. So if they're found to have done it a year later, even under a different manager, I think that that could increase their punishment. The other, you know, also suggesting that something could be coming, in addition to being repeat offenders, the commissioner a week ago today at a press conference here in Florida said that his investigation has been delayed because there have been some new, quote, new developments, and they need to re-interview some people. And I said this on radio thing the other day. You don't re-interview someone to confirm that nothing happened. You know, the new developments are not, you know, just them finding nothing. It's, you know, they found something that, you know, they caused them to have to look into a little
bit
more.
There's a new flyers, so that, maybe.
Yeah. It does not bode super well. On the other side of things, and on a more positive outlook for the Red Sox, they've been punished very severely by this whole sign-stealing thing, by losing their manager, who they loved, who just a year ago had won them the World Series. I think that should not be forgotten. It's definitely not here in camp or by any fan. But, you know, it's still significant. They lost their manager. So that's huge. And the other thing is the Red Sox, to varying degrees within the organization, are professing their innocence. Some, like J.D. Martinez, Devers, Benintendi, are coming out and saying very flatly, we didn't do anything. They're not going to find anything. And that is their, you know, you don't go out on that limb unless you really believe it. And then ownership is saying, we want fans to reserve judgment. We have no reason to think that anything happened. Chaim Bloom the other day even said, we have no reason to think that anything went on. And so we see this organizational kind of push to proclaim innocence when they're really told not to comment. And I think, to me, it would be hard to go out on that limb unless they truly believed it. And if they're found to actually have done something and done something significant, and they're punished significantly, then they're going to look absolutely horrible. So I think all those factors, you know, play into. I think it's like a push at that point, you know, with the negatives and positives. My expectation is they're not going to take – they can't take away the manager. They already did that. Dombrowski's not going to get penalized. And the players are not going to get penalized because they have immunity. So what really – and Bloom wasn't here. So what really can you do? They'll take away a draft pick or two. They'll find the team. It'll be stuff that really doesn't matter that much in the grand scheme of things. So, or as much as, you know, losing Cora was already. So nothing super, super, super drastic or super crazy. I think the worst of the punishment, like I said, was losing the manager in the first place.
And they've already had enough craziness happen around this organization. The swings between high and low with this group is just insane. Within five seasons, you have a championship.
Yep.
You have David Ortiz wading into this after the incident that he went through down in the Dominican. I mean, he has just made himself a public figure again in such a big way. And now we have the Mookie Betts trade, which is going to go down with Babe Ruth as one of the most consequential trades one way or another in Red Sox history. Obviously, everybody's looking at this through a negative lens, me included, but they were able to amend this a little bit with the injury concerns to the Twins pitcher there. They were able to get a little bit more back, but still Alex Verdugo is the center of this, comes into camp with a back injury, and there were quite a few stories about his past. I mean, this whole thing was just such a debacle, and then it flows all the way to Sam Kennedy saying that this wasn't about money. They didn't trade him to get below the luxury tax, which is what I think the prevailing thinking was on this thing. It obviously just centers on the fact that they didn't want to pay him the largest contract in baseball, whatever it would have been. The length is always concerning with those kind of things. I think 13 years is what I hear, which is not something you want to do. But still, when you're getting back guys who are going to be, especially Verdugo, who's going to be left with the expectations of replacing Betts, which is just impossible to assume. This is just a hard thing to do on so many different levels, especially when you consider what people have pointed out, rightfully so, that the organization is making record amounts of money and increasing their money for fan access. It's hard to blame anybody who is just pissed off and, you know, wants to just stop rooting for this organization entirely because of this.
Yeah, I think the view of they're printing money over there, and therefore they can afford whatever they want, including Mookie, is a very simplistic view of things. It doesn't take into account, you know, really how the baseball economic system works. You're penalized for going over that CBT threshold. That CBT threshold is, if you finagle it the right way, a completely made up number. You can look at Will Myers' contract, some of those rumors, to see how that is. The Red Sox simply just didn't want to keep being taxed heavily and didn't want to keep losing draft picks because they're having their draft picks dropped, you know, 10 spots or whatever, and losing money that they're not going to be able to give to free agents in a couple of years, whether that's 20, 30 million. I mean, at the end of the day, that is a significant amount. It wasn't about the money. It was about the CBT, and they view those things through two different lenses. I think where we can fault the Red Sox organization is that they team that had a savvy strategy. They getting under the CBT is a good strategy. Every team's done it. The Dodgers have done it. The Yankees have done it. Everybody's done it, yet the Red Sox just would not cop to it for whatever reason. They just said, yeah, well, oh, by the way, we happen to get under the CBT. I think that was kind of a shady way of presenting it. Obviously, everybody knows that that was a huge motivation here, but a huge motivation of it also was they didn't want to risk Mookie not coming back. Here's at the end of the day, if they thought Mookie was going to re-sign, they would have kept him. They didn't think that. I don't think that he wanted to. I don't think he's coming back. I think he's either going to go to the Braves or the Dodgers or the Padres or some other team that opens up their wallet for
it's
him.
It's funny because we talked about that when John Lester left too. They're like, oh, maybe he'll come back.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he had a better shot than Mookie. But I think that it's one of those things where they didn't want to risk getting nothing for him, getting a compensatory pick. So here they're going to come back and have they acquire four things in this trade. Number one, they don't have to deal with David Price anymore and an aging pitch, a cranky aging pitcher who's making a ton of money and really hamstrings you financially. And then they get three exciting young players back. Verdugo, obviously there's an injury there. Obviously there's some off the field concerns, but once he gets on the field, he's the potential to be an all-star. Dieter Downs, people are really, really excited about. He's a borderline number one prospect in the system. If Verdugo didn't have as much major league service time as he did, he would be the number one prospect in the system, and Downs would be second. And Connor Wong is a guy that they like a lot too. So it's, they actually got a lot. The second return was a lot more palatable than the first one with Gratterall. I agree with that. But the reasons were manifold for the Red Sox to get this done.
It's interesting. The part I always didn't love about this is the fact that Betts and Price go in the same deal. So to me, it looks like Betts is almost sweetener for dumping Price because, you know, I'm not going to say anything about what Price could have provided here because I don't want to say anything nice about Price because he won them a World Series. It's fine. I didn't like the signing in the first place. So in the end, whether he stayed, whether it went, didn't matter all that much to me. Do you think they got less in return because of the fact that he was in that deal and LA's taking on all that money for who knows what kind of return they're going to get from him as a pitcher?
Definitely. But the Red Sox also viewed that, like I just said, as you know, they got four prospects back. They got Alex Verdugo, Dieter Downs, Connor Wong, and financial flexibility. And financial flexibility is not going to be on the field in 2020. But when they go out and sign George Springer, or they go out and sign Trevor Bauer, which would be a very interesting thing for us to come and see. And next winter, I think you're going to look back at this and say, oh, well, there's the David Price money. The Will Myers trade that I just mentioned, if that happens to get done, it's the Will Myers trade, but it's not really, because they'd probably just DFA him. It would turn into the Red Sox taking that $30 million that they saved on Price and buying two pitching prospects from the Padres. And the way Myers' deal is very complicated, I won't get into it, but the CBT hit is $3.8 million instead of Price's $31 million, even though the real money is $30 million. So it would be, just because of the way it works, that's how the Red Sox want to kind of flex their financial might. If they go that path, that would be really, really good, really creative, strong move. And the other one is, in a year, there'll be no limitations. Now the CBT is going to be cleared again, and they'll be in the mix for George Springer, maybe even Mookie Betts, but I doubt it.
Someone, I wish I could credit whoever said this, because it's that good, but they said they looked at Trevor Bauer's Twitter handle, Bauer Outage, and thought it said Bauer Outrage, and it certainly would have fit.
Yeah, it basically does.
Oh, I have no doubt that the Red Sox are going to find a savvy way to get back to contention within the next few years, but whether the Betts trade was the right move or not, the presentation was not great, and that...
Yep.
As much as anything, is a reason for people to get outraged about this. I think you bring up some good points about how they could bounce back to this. But at the end of the day, no amount of flexibility in the world is going to bring a Betts caliber player. And I guess there's always a chance, but I mean, that is just a once in a generational homegrown talent that they had. And through other moves, this is something I think you have to look at as well. Signing those two guys, Hanley, Pablo, who they had to eat money on, the Rusney Castillo deal that they lost money on. There were just a lot of moves and a lot of guys that they had to eat who ultimately lost them flexibility toward being able to keep Betts, which was the guy worth investing in.
Yeah, and all, and the owners say this, so they kind of use it as a cop-out to defend any decision, so I won't go that strong with it, but you know, you can name all the bad contracts in the world, or you can name all the bad trades in the world, and I was an 8-year-old who cried when they traded Nomar at the deadline in July of 2004. They've won 4 World Series and now 16 years, and they had won 0 in the previous 86. So there is a method to this madness. This ownership group is extremely successful. You know, I think it's interesting because I'm a huge Pats guy, not for work, but as a fan. And the Crafts get the benefit of the doubt, and Belichick gets the "in Bill we trust" because they've won 6 championships. If they move on from Brady, I don't think people are going to stick by that. But, you know, the Henry Werner, formerly Lucchino, but now Kennedy regime doesn't get that benefit of the doubt, even though they've won 4 World Series and hired savvy people and done all that, which I think it's a very interesting discrepancy. And I think, you know, everybody's quick to blame the team or quick to blame the player when it comes down to what happened here with Mookie. And I think it's not that simple. I think there was a lot of factors. The Red Sox, we're waiting for Mookie to blink and accept, you know, their contract offer, which was not pennies. It was over $300 million. And he wanted, you know, $420 million, which they didn't want to dish out because they've been scared off a little bit from those mega deals, even, you know, with the Pablo and the Hanley ones that were only a quarter of that. So a lot of factors going into it. And in a year, when we see what Mookie Betts' free agent tour looks like and what he considers and what he gets, you know, maybe the Red Sox well, I think we can judge this whole situation more finally.
He is Chris Cotillo. You're going to read him on MassLive.com along with Chris Smith, who we can't forget. I'm glad you brought him up. Next time you see him, yeah, Tell him to come on. We'll talk about Jim Boeheim and Syracuse hoops.
We'd love it.
We're going to follow you all year long. The Red Sox start March 26th, right, in Toronto. So
yep,
they're starting earlier than ever. It feels like it gets earlier every year. So stick with these two throughout the season. Chris, we didn't get too much in the Daily Dish, but I was glad to learn a little bit about your life here and talk Mookie and everything else. Appreciate you coming on. You can follow him at Chris Cotillo, C-O-T-I-L-L-O. We'll talk to you again here soon, man.
Appreciate it. Thanks.